Donc malheureusement, monsieur, madame Deshpande, pour des soucis de santé, mais pas trop graves, mais pourtant il n'a pas pu être ici, mais il est très, très gentiment. Il nous a envoyé son papier et donc j'ai voulu donc le lire pour vous. Mais donc, ce n'est pas très utile d'avoir une discussion avec quelqu'un qui n'est pas présent. Donc, seulement, ça sera une présentation unilatérale plutôt. Mais pourtant, demandé par Sylvia, j'ai les citations qui sont centrales, qui sont importantes. Je les ai. Pas trop et pas trop nombreux, mais pourtant je les ai traduits si nécessaire en français aussi à côté de l'anglais. Et donc la présentation de Madhav Deshpande, c'est donc intitulé Reviewing the Tradition, Language, Grammar and History. Et voilà, et peut-être c'est difficile à traduire parce que c'est pas exactement la même chose. Reviser la tradition, il y a un jeu de mots, mais la tradition longue, grammaire et histoire. Et donc vous avez vu déjà son abstract, son résumé, et donc on pourrait le traduire en français. Dans mon exposé, je vais passer en revue certaines questions relatives à l'élaboration d'une approche historique de l'étude de la tradition paninienne. En général, les savants traditionnels imprégnés dans l'interprétation des commentaires traditionnels sur Panini ne pensent pas comment cette tradition de la grammaire sanskrite se rapporte à la question générale de l'histoire du sanskrit. L'interprétation des règles de Panini n'est pas statique, elle est un phénomène changeant, et une histoire de ce phénomène changeant pourrait éventuellement être liée à de nombreux aspects différents de l'histoire linguistique, sociale et politique de l'Inde. Et quelles sont les raisons pour lesquelles ces différents commentateurs sont amenés à proposer des interprétations quelque peu différentes? Est-il possible que l'utilisation du sanskrit qu'ils connaissent soit quelque peu différente d'une période à une autre ou d'un lieu à un autre? Est-il possible que les fondements théoriques de la formation des règles grammaticales aient changé au fil du temps? En cherchant le pourquoi de cette différence, on est inévitablement obligé d'élargir sa recherche. L'histoire de la grammaire est liée à l'histoire du langage, mais elle est également liée à l'évolution du contexte religieux, culturel et politique dans lequel vivaient les grammairiens. L'exploration de toutes ces interconnexions possibles rend l'étude de la grammaire sanskrite plus fascinante et enrichissante. Et donc, Madame Deshpande va donc expliquer comment certaines de ces questions sont reflétées dans les commentaires traditionnels sur Panini. Et vous savez bien sûr que Madhav Deshpande est un pionnier dans le domaine de l'approche ou l'étude sociolinguistique de la grammaire de Panini. Donc, il a publié déjà dans les années 90 plusieurs œuvres sur ce problème de sanskrit, prakrit et le rôle de la grammaire. Donc voilà, je commence à lire et je clarifie que la première partie traite de l'expérience de Madhav Deshpande en étudiant la grammaire sanskrite au collège avec des maîtres traditionnels indiens. So when I Madhav Deshpande was studying the tradition of Sanskrit grammar in Pune during my high school and college years. My study of Sanskrit grammar was limited to trying to understand the meaning of a particular commentary on Panini. mostly Bhattoji Dikshita's Siddhanta Kaumudi. I had not thought at that time that the rules of Sanskrit grammar had any connection with the history of Sanskrit language, beyond the limited understanding that the rules of Panini's grammar are required to validate the form of correct Sanskrit. My traditional teachers of Sanskrit, who were steeped in interpreting traditional commentaries on Panini, had themselves generally not thought of how this tradition of Sanskrit grammar related to the general question of the history of Sanskrit nor was it generally perceived that interpretation of Panini's rules is not static, but a changing phenomenon, and that a history of this changing phenomenon could possibly be related to many different aspects of linguistic, social, and political history of India. Several leading senior scholars of Sanskrit in Pune at that time, since the days of Sir R.G. Bhandarkar, were already involved in historical approaches to Sanskrit grammar and other aspects of Indian, ancient Indian culture, but as students, we were generally not exposed to these issues, nor did our examinations require us to explore this historical dimension. Slowly, my own studies, after my arrival at the University of Pennsylvania as a graduate student and at the University of Michigan as a faculty member, drove me to focus my attention on looking at the tradition of Sanskrit grammar from the point of view of history. Donc, prochaine partie, section, c'est l'étude aux États-Unis et regarder la tradition du point de vue de l'histoire, la tradition grammaticale du point de vue de l'histoire. Donc, slowly my own studies drove me to focus my attention on looking at tradition from the point of view of history. In the face of a preliminary study of Panini, using a commentary like the Siddhanta Kaumudi, it is possible to develop a belief that Bhattoji's explanation of a rule of Panini is what that rule is supposed to mean. However, further studies indicate that Katyayana interprets that rule somewhat differently, and that Patanjali, after criticizing Katyayana, develops another distinctive interpretation. Other commentaries offer further modifications. During my early study days, I used to think in categorical terms. All these different interpretations cannot be correct. At the most, one of these is probably correct, and others must be incorrect. Eventually, I began to think differently. What are the reasons that these different commentators are led to offer somewhat different interpretations? Is it possible that the Sanskrit usage they were familiar with was somewhat different from time to time and place to place? Is it possible that the theoretical foundations of grammatical rule formation may have changed over time? In searching for the why of these differences, one is inevitably forced to broaden one's search. History of grammar is connected with the history of language, but it is also connected with the changing religious, cultural, and political environment within which the grammarians lived. Exploring all such possible interconnections made the study of Sanskrit grammar more and more fascinating and rewarding for me. After reading Bhattoji's interpretation of a rule of Panini, if we can say that this is how Bhattoji interprets this rule, rather than asserting that this is what Panini's rule means, we are then free to inquire about how Bhattoji came to interpret this rule in this particular way. Questioning every commentator of Panini in this way, and ultimately questioning Panini himself in this way, we slowly begin to build a broader understanding of intellectual history in ancient India. Voilà. Donc, prochaine étape est donc divergent attitudes to the study of original texts and commentaries. So, language is continuously changing. Similarly, grammatical conceptions are changing, and the change in grammatical conceptions may or may not be related to the change in language, and it could be related to other changes reflected in philosophical or religious traditions of the time. Within the Sanskrit tradition itself, one finds several divergent attitudes to the study of original texts and commentaries. Ram Shankar Bhattacharya, in the publication 1966, points to a passage in Kumarila's Tantra Vartika, Sutre Shweva Hitat Sarvam Yat Virto Yat Javartike. Whatever is found in the commentary and the Vartika is already entirely found in the Sutra. Et il y a une traduction en français aussi. Bhattacharya says that this same tendency is found in the tradition of Sanskrit grammar, in Jinendra Buddhi's commentary Nyasa on the Kashika Vritti, and in Bhairava Mishra's commentary Bhairavi on Nagesha Bhatta's Shabdendu Shekhara. Within this approach, the commentaries do not develop any new ideas, but only bring out what is already hidden in the original sutras. What would be the history of Sanskrit grammar with such an approach? At best, it could be seen as the history of bringing out ideas that are hidden in the original sutras and deemed to be not discovered by the earlier, not yet discovered by the earlier commentators. Even within this approach, one could detect a historically changing aspect of thought. The more prominent idea commonly held within the Paninian tradition is contained in the maxim Uttarottaram Muninam Pramanyam, found in Kayata's commentary Pradipa on Patanjali's Mahabhashya. So, les trois sages de la grammaire font autorité l'un au-dessus de l'autre. This statement is significant in a number of ways. It admits, on the one hand, a historical sequence of Panini, Katyayana, and Patanjali, and that these three munis occasionally differ from each other in their views. On the other hand, it suggests that the level of authority increases with each successive muni. Wherever Katyayana differs from Panini, Katyayana's view prevails over that of Panini. Wherever Patanjali differs from Katyayana, Patanjali's view prevails over that of Katyayana. Kayata's maxim becomes the guiding light for Bhattoji and his successors, and emboldens scholars within this school to reject the views of others if they do not conform with the views of Patanjali. I have pointed out in my previous research that Kayata's maxim needs to be viewed as a reflection of an era when Patanjali, seen as an incarnation of Shesha, has emerged as an incarnate divinity whose authority supersedes that of human scholars like Panini and Katyayana. Kayata refers to Patanjali by the term Naganatha, indicating that he is fully conversant with the notion that Patanjali is the same as Shesha. The grammatical authority of Patanjali seems to rest upon his religious or mythical identity as an incarnation of Shesha. This belief in Patanjali's identity with Shesha is unknown to Bhartahari, even though Bhartahari recognizes Patanjali's authority as Adi Shishta, the foremost among authorities. But for Bhartahari, occasional disagreements with Patanjali are acceptable, something that for Kayata and his successors would become unthinkable. The second aspect of Kayata's statement is that the three founding grammarians are seen as munis, and this status grants them almost a superhuman authority. I have discussed elsewhere how this process of munification of grammatical authorities gradually takes place, and finally culminates in the unflinching acceptance in Kayata and his successors. While Kayata's approach would distinguish between the views held by Panini, Katyayana, and Patanjali, even as it would give final authority to Patanjali's views, there are some even more radical approaches seen in the grammatical tradition. Consider the statement of Maitreya Rakshita in his Tantra Pradipa, Nahi Bhashya Karamatam Anadartya. Nahi bhashya karamatam anadartya sutrakarasya kashchanabhi prayo varnayutum yujyate sutrakara vartika karabhyam tasyaiva pramanya darshanat So Maitreya Rakshita is saying that it is inappropriate to describe any intention of Panini, the earlier one, by setting aside the view of Patanjali, the later one, because Panini and Katyayana have already indicated the authority of Patanjali. This is the most confusing assertion. How did Panini and Katyayana already approve of the authority of Patanjali, who is yet to arrive in history? Such a question disturbs modern scholars. Till we notice that there is a tradition associated with the Nataraja Shiva of Chidambaram that Shesha Patanjali and Panini are together in watching the dance of Nataraja. Grammarians who were centuries apart in terms of a chronological understanding of history are sitting next to each other on the mythic stage of the dance of Nataraja Shiva. Within this mythic world, Panini is seen as accepting the authority of Patanjali. Grammatical conceptions of authority have deep roots in the religious and mythic conceptions. Without this understanding, we can be at a loss to comprehend the statement of a grammarian like Maitreya Rakshita. Before the emergence of such powerful mythologies, Katyayana and Patanjali themselves seem to be relatively free in their critical approach to their predecessors. The genre of Vartika is traditionally defined as Ukta Anukta Durukta Chintakaram Vartikam. Vartika considers what has been said by the original author, what has not been said, and what has not been said well. This characterization of the genre of Vartika fits Katyayana's Vartikas very aptly. Clearly, Katyayana has full respect for Panini, and yet he displays his freedom in questioning Panini's statements. With even greater degree of respect accorded to Panini, Patanjali shows his freedom to question Panini's formulations, as well as Katyayana's statements. Discussing whether the term Vibhasha does or does not continue into successive rules, Patanjali shows his exasperation. Tat etat atyanta sandigdham vartata acharyanam vibhashan vartate na veti. So that means it is very confusing of the respectable teacher whether the term vibhasha does or does not continue in the successive rule. Voilà. In another place, not being able to decide the clear import of Panini, Patanjali says, Deva etat jnatum arhanti, Dieu le sait peut-être. This freedom to question the predecessor is not lost even in the works of Bhartahari. Bhartahari considers Patanjali's Mahabhasha to be the work of a rishi, Archevi Plavite Grandhe. Incidentally, that is at the end of chapter 2, which is a passage probably not belonging to the Karikas, but that's a different thing. Still, it's an old statement that Patanjali is apparently here. The work of Patanjali is Rishi-like or based on a Rishi, and calls him the foremost authority, Adi Shishta. However, he does not show any awareness of Patanjali being an incarnation of Shesha, and he displays his occasional displeasure about certain views of Patanjali. Idam nyaya vidho bhashyakara syapi ayuktam iva lakshyate. This appears to be incorrect even for Patanjali, the author of the Bhashya, who knows logic. As I have described earlier, Kayata's maxim becomes the standard doctrine for Bhattoji Dikshita in recognizing Patanjali's overriding supreme authority. However, even in Bhattoji's works, one occasionally finds interesting remarks that indicate his independent thinking. In his Shabda Kaustubha, Bhattoji says, Nahi tavat vartikam drshtva sutra kurtah pravarti. The author of the sutras does not have the Vartika of Katyayana in his view when he composes his rules. This is a beautiful historical assertion that we can keep in mind in trying to distinguish Panini's views from those of Katyayana and Patanjali. On Panini's rule, Akah Savarni Dirgha, Bhattuji Dikshita, Bhattuji's Siddhanta Kaumudi remarks, Akko Aki Dirgha Iti Eva Suvacham. It would be better to state this rule as Akko Aki Dirgha. To understand this, it needs a little time, which we don't have now. In case there are questions, it can be explained how this comes. But the rule is Akah Savarni Dirgha. Then we go to the next. I would like to briefly discuss, Madhavaj Pandey would like to briefly discuss another example of freedom of thought within the tradition. Panini's rule, na jhalau, is designed to prevent homogeneity, savarnya, between vowels and consonants that could occur in some cases due to identity of point of articulation, sthana, and articulatory effort, prayatna, by the previous rule, tulyasya prayatnam savarnam. The interpretive problems with this rule has kept many commentators busy for centuries. Patanjali on Ashtadhyayi 1.1.10 proposes a finer sub-classification of articulatory efforts so that there is no occasion for any vowels and consonants becoming homogeneous. But if one accepts this newer sub-classification of articulatory efforts, there is no need to have a preventive rule like na jhalau. What should one do? Stick with Panini's understanding of articulatory effort and the formulation of na jhalau, or accept the newer subclassification of articulatory effort and dispense with Panini's rule? Facing this dilemma, Nagesha Bhatta says in his Bharat Shabdendu Shekhara, following. Yadi tu sutra virti, virti adishu, shraddha jadyam apahaya, vayatna bhedat evaitat vyavartya savarnyanam, na savarnyam iti uchyate, tada santu sapta eprayatna, mastu cha na jalav iti sutram. Donc, si on abandonne le caractère ennuyeux de la foi dans les règles et les commentaires, on dit qu'il n'y a pas d'homogénéité entre voyelles et consonnes en raison de la différence dans leur effort articulatoire, que cette sous-classification en sept efforts articulatoires soit acceptée et laissant tomber la règle na jhalau. Et donc, c'est une grande... courage de dire ça, mais à la fin, on a gardé la règle quand même. What Madhavaj Pandey says, it could be conceptualized that you can let fall, that you dispense with the rule of Panini even. So, finally, I want to return briefly to the Patanjali's Mahabhashya. There are places within Patanjali's Mahabhashya where one gets some wonderful glimpses of historical clarity in relation to what is old and what is new, and what works and what does not work. For example, Patanjali points out that Katyayana newly proposes a definition of a sentence, vakya, and suggests that certain grammatical operations take place under the condition within the same sentence. And then he says, idam adya apurvam kriyate vakya sanjana samana vakya adhikarascha. He is pointing to a new development in grammatical description, initiated by Katyayana, in comparison with Panini's original formulations. There are many such places in the Mahabhashya that are useful in reconstructing a developmental history of grammatical conceptions. This points to a need to distinguish what is historically Paninian and what is not. Making such distinctions is absolutely essential in arriving at historical clarity in our understanding. Besides this distinction, Patanjali makes another distinction, namely theories or formulations that work and that don't work. Patanjali's 16, Patanjali says, Siddhyati evam apaniniyam tu bhavati. This way the grammatical procedure is successful, but the procedure becomes unpanini. This is a wonderful formulation, and we can extract some useful guidance from its implications. This gives us two independent parameters to evaluate every grammatical formulation, namely, is it historically Paninian or not, and whether it is successful or not. Historical Paninian procedures, formulations may or may not be successful in achieving their goals, and similarly, non-Paninian procedures or formulations may or may not be successful in achieving their goals. Deciding whether a certain formulation is Paninian or unpaninian requires a different kind of investigation as compared to judging the success or failure of a certain formulation. Paul Kiparski's investigation of the distinctive meanings of the option terms va, preferably, and vibhasha, marginally, and anyatarasyam, optionally, is a modern example of discovering the most likely intended meanings of these terms in Paninian grammar, which were not known to the tradition. Kiparski's methodology of judging the resulting formations in reference to their relative statistical or statistics of actual occurrences is a new advance over the traditional mode of argumentation, and yet it resulted in a conclusion that can be stated in Patanjali's words as Siddhyati evam paniniyam cha bhavati. There are many places in Patanjali's Mahabhashya where he discusses the new proposals made by Katyayana. In some places he defends Katyayana's new formulations while he rejects them in other places. In those cases where he finds Katyayana's suggested formulations not yielding the desired results, one needs to say na evam siddhyati apaniniyam cha bhavati. The procedure is neither successful and nor is it Paninian. But in such places, we need to take a close look at the notion of the success of a grammatical procedure in deriving a desired formation. Were Panini, Katyayana, and Patanjali dealing with the same state of that same language, or were they dealing with different states of an evolving language? This is an old debate, and I am just referring to it to bring it back into a new examination. Especially in the era of computerization of Panini's grammar to computationally derive Sanskrit formations, the historical aspect of the Paninian interpretation needs to be taken into account. If we assume that Panini composed his grammar to derive the language of the Shishtas as he knew it, are we by chance using his grammar to derive Sanskrit formations that he may not have been aware of and probably did not intend to derive? I have drawn attention to some usages of found in the Northwestern Sanskrit that seem to fit certain rules of Panini, for which we do not find attestations coming from later Sanskrit literature produced in different regions of India. Hans Heinrich Hock has taken this investigation further in arguing that while Panini was a grammarian from the Northwestern frontier of India, Katyayana and Patanjali were describing the Sanskrit of the Madhya Desha. It is useful to remind ourselves that the standard usage of Sanskrit for Patanjali comes from their central region of Aryavarta, which is to the east of Punjab, west of Prayaga, to the south of the Himalayas, and to the north of the Vindhyas. Panini's homeland of Shalatura in the Swat Valley in the northwest is far outside Patanjali's Aryavarta, and yet he is using Panini's grammar as a tool to teach the standard Sanskrit of this Aryavarta. With the spread of Sanskrit far and wide beyond the Aryavarta in later times, with the commentators emerging from Kashmir to the southern tip of India, Panini's grammar is being adapted to serve the purpose of defining and justifying Sanskrit usages emerging in this extended geography. In this process, we need to carefully observe how new interpretations of Panini's old rules are being proposed by commentators to justify new standards of Sanskrit usage that they are familiar with. Research in Paninian grammar must come to terms with such changing circumstances of history. And that is the conclusion of Mala Deshpande's paper.